Welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I am a resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society, and I thank you for coming back and listening after a 1 month just about hiatus. I am very pleased today to have the honor of interviewing and having as a guest Professor Lawrence Lessig. Professor Lessig is the, among other things, the most relevant to me personally, is he is the founder and head of the Center for Internet and Society, in which I am a resident fellow. Professor Lessig, Larry's reputation precedes him, but suffice to say that he was the Berkman Professor of Law at Harvard Law School, a professor at the University of Chicago, clerked for both Judges Richard Posner and Justice Scalia, and has been at the forefront of the re-evaluation and discovery of what technology means in society going back quite a while. So, Larry, thank you for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
Why don't we start right off with kind of a general overview of two organizations that I think kind of will set the context. If you could tell us a little bit about both Creative Commons and CIS as you see it to kind of frame the conversation, that would be great.
Well, these are two organizations that differently allow me to do work in areas that I find extremely interesting. I mean, the CIS, Center for Internet Society, is generally concerned with the interaction between technology and policy. So the range of issues has considered things like the net neutrality debate or the end-to-end architecture of the Internet and privacy and copyright issues, the full range of places where technology and legal policy need to learn how to talk to each other. The Creative Commons is very different. It's not a research organization. It's a nonprofit that we started in 2002 for the purpose of making it easy for artists and authors and scientists to mark the creativity that they produce with the freedoms they intended to carry. And the reason for that was to give them a simple way to encourage people to do the sort of things that many people think comes naturally with the Internet, like sharing content or remixing content or making it available in different languages. Those freedoms, of course, are rights which the author has to give away, but it's pretty hard, given the existing copyright system, to do that in a standard, understandable way. So that's why we started Creative Commons. That's not really copyright policy work. I mean, I do, through the center, we do a lot of litigation around copyright policy. But it's more practical, trying to make the copyright system function through this private voluntary system to make it function better.
Do the various organizations in which you're involved all seem to have a general common theme? Certainly it's something that drew me to CIS, which is really, at the broadest level, the reevaluation of many laws. But the main focus often and is intellectual property. And if you were to sum up the general importance of intellectual property in light of technology is today, how would you put it? You've spoken about it various times. I'm curious to see how we'd frame it today.
Well, when I went to law school, which was many, many years ago, I graduated in 89, nobody took intellectual property law. It was a tiny little subject that, people who wanted to be Hollywood lawyers might take, but nobody else did. Everybody, when I went to law school, was really into constitutional law. It was just at the moment that Eastern Europe was beginning to liberate, and so constitutions was where all the action was. Today, in any law school, that is completely reversed. The sexy, interesting subjects are intellectual property. Nobody cares about constitutional law anymore. And that's largely because intellectual property has moved from a peripheral concern of most people's of the law to right at the center, because there's basically nothing you can do in the context of the Internet, for example, that doesn't in some way trigger the application of copyright law and therefore trigger concerns about whether copyright law is too extensive or not strong enough. And again, that's radically different from the way the world was before the Internet. Before the Internet, you could go through your whole life never once triggering copyright law, at least if you didn't use a Xerox machine. But most people, didn't do things that triggered copyright law, because copyright law requires things like copies or public performances before it's going to be triggered. But in the Internet, everything you do is a copy. So by default, copyright law becomes much more relevant, and that sets the stage for the struggles about whether it's too central to the creative process and needs to be cut back a bit to make it take its proper place.
This past week, you gave a talk at Harvard Law School at a discussion conference involving Wikipedia, and it's interesting from the accounts that I've read of the talk that a lot of the focus turns on the concept of read-only versus read-write cultures. For those people who are not familiar with these terms, what is the core difference between those two? And given that we're in a read-write culture, what does that mean for technology and for how people interact with it?
Well, the basic concept, read-only versus read-write, is suggested by computer technology. So, for example, an ordinary CD is a read-only medium, meaning that you can read the content on the CD, but you can't change it. But a hard disk is a read-write medium, at least if you have permissions, because you can both read the content and you can change it and store the changes. And that distinction is, I think, an illuminating way to think about your rights with respect to culture. So when you go to Apple iTunes and you download a song, you have the right, because of that download, to play that song, to consume that song. But you don't have the right to do anything with that song. You don't have the right to remix it or to share it with your friends. All you've gotten is the right to consume it, or in the metaphor of read-only, just the right to read it. But an extremely important part of what the Internet is becoming is that platform through which people not only consume culture, but they create and share their creativity. Pew did a study and found that 57% of teenagers had created and shared content on the Internet. That's not people who had peer-to-peer file shared. That number is probably more like 99%. But these are people actually creating content and sharing it on the Internet. And that act of creativity requires certain freedoms. And those are the freedoms that I think I'm referring to in thinking about a read-write culture, the permission to read and then make comment upon and change and then share your changes with others. Now, by talking about it in these terms of read-only and read-write, it makes it sound like this is something new with the new digital technologies. But in fact, my point is that our culture has always been a read-write culture. You know, before computers, you go watch a movie and then you sit down with your friends and you critique it, or you use it as a joke and with other friends, or it becomes a point of reference with your spouse or with your lover. And the point is that this is culture that you're using in your life, and you're changing it perhaps, and you're sharing it with others. The difference technology gives us is now we can share it not just with your five best friends, but with anybody else on the Internet. So technology has enhanced the capacity of people to produce and share culture. But the activity, this critical or this act of critique of culture is really nothing new.
Is the read-write culture that you're referring to, although it's nothing new, I think seems to be something which for many people, they're just not thinking in those terms. They're used to consuming, as you mentioned. They're used to not being involved. At the broadest level, what has been the reaction of people that are not immersed in technology, for whom they really haven't thought about this? How are they reacting to this distinction? Are they finding it something that really causes them to rethink their interaction with technology and perhaps to rethink what the law is doing to it? Where are we in that discussion?
Well, it's a great question because, I introduced this idea by talking about some testimony given in the United States Congress 100 years ago by John Philip Sousa. June 6, 1906. And Sousa had come to Congress to complain about what he called the talking machines. And he reminisced in this testimony about how when he was a young man, when he was growing up, in the summer evenings you would find young people together singing the songs of the day or the old songs. And he complained that what the talking machines were going to do was to, quote, remove the vocal cords of culture, because people would no longer be practiced in the act of like singing and reproducing culture. They'd just be consuming culture. They'd just be listening to the infernal machines, as he said, going night and day. And so what Sousa is celebrating there is exactly this read-write activity. You know, the idea of people getting together and singing the songs of the day was not something he celebrated because they were paying royalties when they did it. He was celebrating it because it made a robust productive, creative culture. And what he feared was this world where people would just passively consume culture, the kind of couch potato culture. Now, you know, the reality is Sousa was right, at least about the 20th century. If you think about the 20th century, it was bizarre in the history of human culture. This is the one century where culture had been so effectively professionalized and concentrated, and you know, ordinary people feel kind of unentitled to participate in the act of creating and sharing culture. It's the sort of thing that, you know, you buy CDs to do. As you get people to see how the 20th century was weird in this one sense, this one time when, you know, we gave up our vocal cords and turned it all over to the professionals, it makes it easy for people to then imagine once again what it would be like for people once again to enter into this act of creating and sharing culture. And that's the thing that I think digital technologies are really encouraging. I mean, when you see what kids are doing with these technologies, of course, there's, you know, file sharing or, quote, stealing the record labels content all over the place, no doubt. And I'm not a supporter of that. But what I find really exciting is when I see, you know, kids taking a song and a video and mixing them together in a way that makes a really intelligent or powerfully critical point, in a way that, you know, any of us would be proud if we could do just writing an essay or writing an op-ed in the New York Times. That writing now is not just writing with words. Writing now is writing with video and audio, and that kind of creativity we ought to be encouraging. And that's exactly what read-write culture celebrates, and that's what I think the law ought to be encouraging, but instead is inhibiting.
Now, it wasn't too long ago, and in talks that I've seen you do, that you've mentioned and used as an example the Peanuts Hey Ya video, the mashup. And for those that aren't familiar with it, I think I can describe pretty quickly, which is taking portions of a Peanuts cartoon and basically syncing that with the Outkast song Hey Ya. Now, the issue there, again, is exactly the kind of creativity you're describing, and yet you pointed out that that video was subject to a cease and desist letter by the owner of Peanuts Cartoons and shut it down. We're talking about something that happened a couple of years ago. Am I right about that? So where are we now from that kind of view? I think there's a big debate as to whether, without getting too specific, whether these are in fact creative works. Now, I certainly think they are. You think they are, but I think a lot of people are dubious on that point. Are things have just in the since the time that that video was basically taken down, as it were? Do you see movement in the direction of understanding what this technology means and how it really is a creative medium?
Well, you're right. There are a lot of people who say, why do you need to remix other people's works? Why don't you just make your own work? And the suggestion there is that it's easy to remix and hard to create your own work. But I think people who think that it's easy to remix are people who've never tried to do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the talent involved in doing it well, meaning selecting the kind of things that go together and how they go together, is really extraordinary. I mean, it's hard to describe this on the radio. You should go to a site, all of you, a Swedish site called atmo.se, A-T-M-O.se, and there's a series of videos this production company has done called Read My Lips. And what they do is they synchronize music to the lips of famous people. Some of them are pretty silly, but some of them are really brilliant. My favorite is the Bush Blair Endless Love. So here you have Lionel Richie's song Endless Love. Lionel Richie, a Republican, of course. And the song is George Bush singing the male part and Tony Blair singing the female part of an Endless Love duet to each other. And as you listen to the words, it's a perfect kind of political commentary on the relationship between America and Britain, especially during this recent war. Now, you know, the depth and power of that commentary, you know, the number of things you can reflect upon, the power in its message, is, I think, impossible to capture in 500 or 800 words of an op-ed in the New York Times. But it's doing exactly the thing that an op-ed in the New York Times is supposed to do. It's supposed to be making a point about the politics of this relationship. And it does it powerfully. Now, you can like it or not, but I think, you know, my perspective is, What power, what right does the government have to use law to stop you from that kind of creativity? Now, the formal power the government has is enforcing something called copyright. And I'm a believer in copyright. I think it's very important. It's essential for many forms of creativity. You won't have Hollywood movies if you didn't have copyright, and I am not a cultural elitist. I love Hollywood movies. I have no taste when it comes to film. So I want to make sure that all forms of creativity can exist, and, you know, a $50 million Hollywood movie, if there weren't any copyright, just couldn't exist. But it's one thing to say that I'm not allowed to take George Lucas's latest film and make 50,000 copies of it and sell it to my friends or give it away. I understand that, and I understand why restricting my freedom there is essential to creating the incentives for Lucas to make his films. I don't understand why it's essential for the law to be able to say that Lionel Richie can stop this artist, Atmo.se, from synchronizing his music in a way that makes a political point about either Lionel Richie or about George Bush. That doesn't reduce or eliminate any of the sales that Lionel Richie has. Lionel Richie has all the incentives he would have had before to create his great new work. And restricting people in that way really does restrict the opportunity for culture to be used for political or even cultural purposes. So the point is just to recognize that to the extent copyright law is a restriction on speech, it needs to be justified. That's not to say it can't be justified, but it is to say that people, especially copyright owners, have to be open to giving us the reasons why it makes sense for the government to play a role in silencing the uses of speech in the name of copyright.
The antecedents and the examples that you use from the Steamboat Willie to what you've mentioned with John Philip Sousa and going forward, all obviously, not a profound point, are dealing with technologies and uses that simply have been made much easier today. The work necessary to paint one cell of a cartoon obviously today is something that one could do at home, as you've pointed out. But does the ease with which one can create these works necessarily justify changing the law as it's existed? And what I mean by that is a lot of people would say that the laws worked pretty well. And so is the point that now that we have technology which creates a greater impact of the law, that the law should change? Or is it that the law itself no longer applies properly to the world in which we live?
Well, I think we should turn it around. We should, again, ask the question, what justification does the law have for its restriction on my freedom? Now, you're right. One of the most amazing things about these digital technologies is that it makes it much easier to be creative. You know, so in the 1960s, you wanted to be a musician, you had to spend 10 years of your life learning how to play the guitar. And some people weren't rich enough to do that, meaning they didn't have the time or the resources to be able to do that, so they couldn't become guitarists, they couldn't become musicians. Today, you can take a laptop and after a month have the facility necessary to begin to create really creative, powerful sounds and recordings that are compelling and people want to listen to. So you could say, well, the technology has just made it easier, but by making it easier, the technology has invited a wider range of people to be creative. And that act of being creative is an essential human characteristic. We ought to be celebrating it, not trying to quash it. So I don't think we should demean the fact that it's easier. I think it's a good thing that it's easier. Now, when it's easier, lots more people are going to be creating in ways that infringe upon the traditional understanding of copyright. And my view is what we should do is ask the question whether that infringement is really hampering some kind of incentive which the copyright owner needs to create great new work. Because if it's not restricting the incentives or not eliminating incentives, then my bias is on the side of freedom. I think the presumption should be you should be free to do, especially with speech, whatever you want to do, unless there's a good reason to say no. And if there's not even a reason like, well, I can't have the incentive to produce this movie, or I'm not going to be able to afford to create the next four records I want to produce, if there's not anything like that justification, I don't think there's any justification for restricting the freedom.
It kind of moves me into a little bit different direction, but one I wanted to touch on. You've spoken very highly of Professor Yochai Benkler's relatively new book, The Wealth of Networks, and I've had the pleasure of reading it. Professor Benkler's book is, I think, written for an audience that is looking to learn in a very broad way, well beyond just technology, into how society shares information today. And its application, the book itself, its application ranges from politics to business to anything in between. Where, with regard to Professor Benkler's book and the read-write culture, how are these books being received generally as you go around and speak to people about these issues, and when you're speaking to people that aren't in fact resident fellows at CIS, what's your sense of how people are reacting to this wealth of really brilliant, wonderful work that's been done in this area?
Well, I'm not sure I'm a good measure of how people react or are reacting to it, because I don't spend a lot of time trying to pull that kind of information. But where I see especially Benkler's work resonating, it's because it's resonating with things that in some level we all know to be true. So one thing that Benkler's trying to get people to recognize is that production or creativity is not something you only do at work, where work is understood to be the thing you do from 9 to 5 if you're lucky. And if you're unlucky, you do it either from 9 to 9 or not at all. But that sort of commercial work, we might call it, is really one part of ordinary human life. You know, we have lots of other ways we interact with people, and those ways in which we interact sometimes take a lot of effort. So, you know, we have hobbies, or we might join volunteers at a church to do certain activities, or we might volunteer to do activities that help a community center. These are all things that we all do because we want to do it. Now, what Benkler is getting people to see is how the technologies of the internet are enabling a much wider range of this peer production of things of great value. One of his favorite examples is Wikipedia, which, of course, is this encyclopedia, which is produced on a wiki, meaning technology where literally anybody can sign up and change whatever you find on the wiki. And the community that supports this Wikipedia, encyclopedia, is a community that's constantly monitoring what's changed and trying to evaluate whether the changes are improvements or not, and rolling back changes that might be really nothing more than a defacement, but then encouraging changes that actually are improving the quality of the encyclopedia. And what's astonishing about this encyclopedia is that, 10 years ago, if somebody had said, a bunch of volunteers are going to write an encyclopedia from scratch without any coordinating editor, without anybody who has the authority to decide what's good and what's bad, 99% of the world would have said that's impossible. But, in fact, it is possible. There is evidence of it. It is Wikipedia. And Wikipedia has been demonstrated to be at least as good as, you know, ordinary edited encyclopedias. So this is an extraordinary surprise. We would not have predicted it, which means that our theories for understanding why people do what they do are incomplete. And what Yochai is trying to do is to give us a richer understanding of why people do what they do. And, you know, not surprisingly, a lot of times people do what they do because money is not involved. And one of the things Yochai spends a lot of time trying to warn people about is the danger that comes from taking an activity which is a voluntary activity and changing its meaning by introducing money into the equation. Because once you introduce money into the equation, people's relationship to the project changes. Like if some people are being paid, then you feel like you're a chump if you're not being paid, or you begin to think about it in commercial terms as opposed to the kind of community terms that were supporting it. And what this means is you need to work hard to really balance the incentives for creating these fantastic new sources of wealth to make sure that you're, you know, mixing the incentives in the way that actually produces the most wealth. And that's really the focus of much of Wealth of Networks, which of course is a reworking of Adam Smith's famous Wealth of Nations, It's dangerous to use to title your book in a way that evokes maybe the most important book in political theory.
Right.
But I think he is entitled to it because I think this is the most important work in political theory in the last 50 years.
And with that level of praise, to summarize its importance, why do you hold such a strong opinion about the book? What is its impact as you see it?
Well, you know, for somebody, I've been struggling to understand this area for a long time, and writing, now three books that sort of make small contributions to how we can understand it. What was so refreshing about reading Yochai's book is that it felt like it was pulling together an extraordinary amount of work that a bunch of us and others, a bunch of people have been doing for the last 15 years in a way that made it compelling and made it make sense. So it's not like Yochai has come along and discovered theory of relativity, which really was a kind of discovery that forced the world to change how it saw itself. But it is the case that he's brought together things in a way that makes coherent an understanding of what's happening here. That really, if it's taken seriously, and it certainly will be taken seriously, will change the way both policymakers and business think about this area. I mean, a related book is a work by Eric von Hippel called Democratizing Innovation. And von Hippel is a MIT professor, and what he studies is examples of companies that basically open up the process of innovation for their products. So companies that invite the customer to modify and change the product and then learn from those changes how to make the product better. This is a similar story because it's about giving up some of the control, making it a more peer-to-peer process of creating, and in that process actually producing more valuable products and more profitable companies. So I think von Hippel's work is more compelling in this particular respect, but the point that both von Hippel and Benkler are making is this is not a kind of left-right, we're for profit or we're against profit like debate. This is both of these books and a lot of the work in this era is trying to demonstrate that we need to learn how we can use these technologies to increase wealth in society generally, and that's both wealth for commercial entities and wealth for the rest of society. But the point is, our intuitions developed in the physical world don't map automatically to what's going on in the digital world.
The left-right distinction is one that I wanted to talk about a little bit today because it also just gets to the good-bad distinction. You've mentioned a few times here, and I've certainly discussed it with others, that to be in favor of modernizing, if you will, copyright law to adequately reflect concepts like fair use does not equate with the idea that it's okay to steal a song for which you have no right and distribute it. And yet, when people view these issues, they do often take a left-right view of it. You hear phrases like copy left and things like that, which imply that this idea has at its bedrock an ideology which is liberal or, and of course the hated word democratic, in the capital D sense. And yet the point you're making is one I want to explore a little bit. To me, these aren't left-right issues. And to me, they aren't even good-bad issues. And yet so many political issues, and unfortunately I think this is one of them, is beholden to these monikers. What can be done for those people who are interested in this issue, beyond learning about it, although I want to talk about that at the end for any recommendations of places to read more, but what can be done to move this debate beyond the left-right stale dichotomy, beyond obviously the major work, which is the scholarship that needs to exist to undergird it?
Well, you're absolutely right, that unfortunately the debate is too often framed in these traditional left-right terminology. And that's unfortunate because I think that, when you can frame a debate in left-right terminology, you stop thinking about the debate. I mean, you stop thinking because if it's seen as a lefty issue, then people on the left automatically accept it, people on the right automatically reject it, and they don't even have to think in order to get to that particular position. And I think that what we need to recognize is that both sides of this debate need to think about how to incorporate the insights of this new kind of technology into social life. So I think that there's a real obligation to make sure that we don't characterize the debate in a way that makes it sound like it's really just a debate on the left and a debate on the right. And I genuinely think it's not. And the reason for that is that, you know, in some sense, the type of issues that concern me in the intellectual property debate really can be described in radically different ways, but to the same end. So, for example, you could talk about the restrictions on copyright, on the ability for people to create, and emphasize, as I was before, the kind of free speech dimension. Like, I have the right to create, and the idea that the state's going to come in and stifle that, that's a censorship on my creativity. That makes it sound like a very lefty kind of concern. But you can tell the same story from a Republican perspective. You could say, here's a bunch of federal regulations on the creative process. Regulations that have been drafted over many years by special interest groups who are concerned primarily with benefiting their legacy business models and stifling new forms of creativity. So this type of regulation, like every type of regulation, ought to be looked at skeptically, and we ought to constantly force the regulator to justify his regulations. And that justification would often, in my view, result in a relaxing of many of the copyright regulations, because many of them, again, don't serve the underlying purpose of copyright, which is to inspire new creativity. You can tell the story from both sides. All of us should practice telling it from both sides. But people, especially on the right, need to become part of this debate, because unfortunately the special interests in Washington have done a really good job in making it sound like this is a debate about whether you're in favor of property or not. Now that's such a crude simplification of the debate, because on one level, we're all for property. I'm for copyright. Copyright's a kind of property. We ought to have a proper property system here functioning in the way that it should, to preserve and create the incentives necessary. But the issue isn't whether you're for property or against property. The issue is whether the particular way in which copyright regulates creativity is actually productive and actually is encouraging creativity. And I think in 1,000 examples we can see how its regulation now is not protecting or encouraging creativity as much as protecting a particular form, a particular business model that happens to be fortunate enough to have lots of legislative support in Congress.
With the time that we have left, I kind of want to ask you the hated question, which as a litigator I always despised, which is the crystal ball question. People always ask me as a litigator, are we going to win? And, you know, it's a tough one to answer. So with that caveat, if you were to look into the crystal ball 5 years from now, with the development, with the work of people like Benkler and your own and von Hippel, and really what I think are more and more conversations that are occurring about the fact that the law is antiquated in a lot of ways, 5 years from now, where are we?
Well, the first point to be clear about is, you know, neither I nor Benkler nor von Hippel nor any of these people are leaders in building the reality that we describe. You know, we're academics, we're reflective, we reflect on what we see. And so necessarily we're 5 years behind. The real heroes here are the people who are actually building this new world, this new world of creativity, innovation, commerce, and democratic politics. Now, those people don't have time to sit down and write books, right? They're working 24 hours a day to build something new. And when I look at what they're actually building, I can't help but be extremely excited about it. And especially excited by the explosion in the movement of people who are aware of these issues and are really activated to try to do something to protect this opportunity from the damage that the government can do when the government steps in and regulates to protect vested interests. On the other hand, the vested interests here are really, really strong. So one debate that I've been in the middle of really since I came to Stanford has been the debate about what we now call network neutrality. And that's a debate about whether the network owners, the people who own the wires, who have a license to the spectrum across which you get access to your internet connection, have the right to pick and choose what applications will run on the network. Do they have the right to say, well, this voice over IP application, which makes it so you can get telephone service for almost nothing, competes with our telephone service, so we're going to block that. Or this content is critical of cable companies, so we're not going to allow that. Or this content is too supportive of right-wing positions, so we're not going to allow that. Or it's too Christian-y, and we don't like Christian-y stuff on our network because Christian-y stuff sort of scares away rich liberals who would otherwise spend money on our network. So the point there is that the network owners have this capacity now because of technology built by the technologists throughout Silicon Valley to begin to discriminate, pick and choose what content flows quickly, pick and choose what applications are allowed. And the fundamental question here is whether policymakers will allow these network owners to exercise that power. Now, the critical first point to recognize is that this power is an inversion of the traditional values and architecture of the Internet. The Internet was originally architected as an end-to-end network, which meant that the network itself was stupid. It couldn't enter in, it couldn't discriminate at all about how content was being used on the network. So all decisions about what would run on the network were decisions produced by people at the edge of the network, the users of the network. And if we allow the network owners to exercise that control, we will have changed the fundamental design of the Internet to this decentralized democratic design to a much more corporate centralized design. And the second thing to recognize about it is that if we allow that to happen, lots of the growth and innovation on this network just won't happen. And the best evidence of that is by looking backwards and asking, picking out examples of the most important innovations that happened in the history of the Internet. And you know, my list includes, for example, the original protocols of the network, which were invented here at Stanford by Bob Kahn and Vint Cerf. These were two kids in the field of network theory, to the World Wide Web that was invented by a Swiss researcher, to ICQ, which is the first peer-to-peer instant messaging chat system, which was invented by an Israeli teenager, to HTML mail, Hotmail, which was invented by an Indian immigrant, to Napster or Yahoo or Google, all of which were invented by college kids. If you look at all of these major innovations, they were all invented either by non-Americans or kids. And that's an extremely important feature of the original Internet, that it invited outsiders to be the innovators. But if we flip that around, then it's not outsiders who have the right to innovate or have the opportunity to innovate. It's the friends of AT&T or the friends of Comcast. And that is a really damaging transformation. Now, this debate, when you talk about it with ordinary people or with people who've been around the Internet from the very beginning, seems obvious. But in Washington, where policymakers, you know, congressmen, have no time to read anything and spend all of their time raising money so they can be reelected, they don't understand this history at all. And so when the cable companies and the telephone companies come into Washington and spend literally millions of dollars to lobby on this issue and lobby in very simplistic terms about whether they have the right to do with their property what they want, these policymakers, these congressmen are basically bought. And it's a kind of corruption in the system. They realize that if they're going to get the money they need to get reelected from these most powerful lobbyists, they're going to have to give them what they want. And so this soul of the Internet, this feature of the Internet that was at its core, is being auctioned off in Washington right now because the power is all in the hands of those who have money to lobby, and those who have money to lobby are the traditional vested interests and businesses who are trying to protect themselves from a new form of competition. And that's exactly what's happening here. That, I think, is going to happen in a lot of contexts. So in that sense, when I look at that reality of the way Washington works, I get very I'm very pessimistic because I don't see yet a way to crack that reality. The business is the only way you get policy passed is by making it profitable for the politicians, which means feeding their endless need to raise money to run for election. And it turns out that the truth doesn't necessarily have a pack behind it.
It's a enlightening and somewhat distressing picture that appears. What, for people that are looking to learn more and get involved, I would be remiss in not offering the opportunity for any suggestions that you might have, both Creative Commons and otherwise.
Well, if you want to get involved in the kind of activism about these issues, then the best sites, in my view, are Public Knowledge, publicknowledge.org, and EFF.org. So Public Knowledge is a kind of inside Washington lobbying organization trying to get the other side of the story out. And EFF has been fighting about these issues of civil liberties on the Internet since the birth of the Internet. If you want to learn more about privacy issues, then I think EPIC EPIC.org is the traditional great place to learn about those issues. And copyright reform issues, EFF is a good supporter for this too, but Creative Commons, which is not really trying to change the law, but just allow the law as it is right now to be used to create a more balanced system, Creative Commons is the place to go. So that's creativecommons.org. And if you believe in this, then you ought to join the 140 million other websites out there that do this. You ought to add a Creative Commons license to your website to express the freedom that you believe your content should carry, so that we can begin to show the control freaks that the world isn't divided into pirates and those who believe in all rights reserved, but instead there's a very healthy middle here, a middle that wants to support freedom to do the sort of things that the Internet's great at doing without necessarily giving away all the rights that copyright law grants somebody. So those are places I would start.
Well, Larry, it's been, as I'm finding, an hour, 45 minutes, not nearly enough. We're scraping the surface. But I want to thank you so much for taking the time out of your extremely busy schedule to talk with me today. Of course, I invite you back to continue the discussion. And again, thank you so much for being here. I think this has been quite enlightening.
Thanks a lot, David.
Thank you, Larry. So that was Larry Lessig, the founder of CIS. And I think, like I said, for me, the really driving force behind my interest in this area, my interest to come back to Stanford. So we'll take a short music break, and when I return, we'll sum up the show. I want to thank Professor Lessig, Larry Lessig, coming in today to chat with me about the myriad of issues that we're facing, both as a society and everyone living in it, but also as people interested in technology and the law. Larry's words, while being kind of distressing at one level, also indicate how people really can get involved in these issues. My intention on this show is not to be a preacher for one particular cause or particular viewpoint, but at the same time, I think the kind of work that Larry's done, as well as like Yochai Benkler and Jamie Boyle at Duke and really many other people, is work that is of increasing importance, because technology is one of those things that is more and more a part of everyone's life. And getting back to the original name and title of my show, Hearsay Culture, I was compelled by the basic idea, as Larry was talking about, that we are in a read-write culture, a read-write world, where we have to be the filters. We have to be, as individuals, the people to decide, well, is this worth our time? Is this worth our effort? Is this something that should be subject to weight? Is it something to which I should give credence? And we're in a society where, so long as the law, as many people interpret it and as many courts interpret it, is stuck in a world where the only people creating are the people with massive resources or just massive contact, we really risk quashing what is an amazing deployment of technology and more broadly and more importantly, a major transformation in how we share information. Certainly, Larry's endorsement of Yochai Benkler's book doesn't require much of an echo, but suffice it to say that I agree with its impact in this area. And it really is, even if one to skim it merely reads the introduction and the first chapter, you get a very good idea of where we're going and why this kind of form of sharing spurred by technology is so important across the board, well beyond the creative world and the crucible of intellectual property. In Larry's book, The Future of Ideas, the second of the three books that he's written in this area, there's one quote that I'd want to read, and it's page 104 of the paperback version of the book for anyone who wishes to look for it. But the quote kind of sums up, this discussion today and where we are. The quote is, "The aim is therefore not to find a world without constraint. It is to remove the constraints that might otherwise inhibit innovation. Just because it is good that sonnets forbid rambling paragraphs, it doesn't follow that a tax on books would inspire better writing. And that analogy really, and I've actually quoted that quote to other guests and other people, other guests on this show, really I think sums up the kind of debate that we're facing now. The idea that the law itself would actually quash the innovation, would quash new ideas in the name of interest that may or may not be valid is really the core of the question. And this requires a reexamination, even if it means that ultimately the public, in the capital P sense, decides that the law is okay. The point is, at least initially, we need to get to the point where we're doing a true and forthright and complete reconsideration of where we are, what the law means, and how it's impacting the society in which we live. So with that kind of sum up, I want to close this portion of the show and again remind you that Hearsay Culture is a show which is on the air Wednesdays from 5 to 6 p.m. Pacific Standard Time on KZSU Stanford. You can, of course, also listen to the show, and hopefully many of you are, by streaming, going to kzsu.org, and also by podcast on iTunes, where you can find this show. I am in the process of creating a website that will be a further exploration, of the topics that we discuss on each show, with a goal of having both links to resources and to sites that guests mention, as well as just further opportunity for discussion of the topics that we discuss in a particular week. I'm in the process of putting that site together. It does take some time. I, of course, welcome any comments or suggestions about the show or about the future website from anyone that's listening, and you can feel free to email me at dlevine@law.stanford.edu. Again, that's dlevine@law.stanford.edu. You can, of course, always learn about what's happening at Stanford's Center for Internet and Society, CIS, by going to CIS's webpage, which is cyberlaw.stanford.edu. Again, cyberlaw.stanford.edu. I'm in the process of finalizing guests for the coming weeks. I'm looking forward next week to interviewing the people that are involved with the magazine, Stay Free, as well as other people in academia and in the technology sector who want to discuss these issues. And of course, I should mention, as I have repeatedly, that should you have any thoughts on future guests or people I should be talking to or interviewing, again, I'm open to all suggestions. My goal with this show is really to broaden the horizons of people who are not necessarily focusing on these issues or thinking about them regularly, but perhaps should or at least would like to start doing that. So that pretty much sums up the show. The show's a little shorter today, but I think the value was there, and certainly the discussion, I think, was far-ranging and covered quite a bit of ground in a short amount of time. So I want to thank you again for listening to Hearsay Culture. This show, by the way, is being recorded on August 9th, so it's airing about 1 week after its recording, and that's one of the nice things about having a radio station to work in. We can record shows and air them later, as opposed to being having to go live every time. So I want to thank you again for listening to Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine, a resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society, and please stay tuned for more really far-ranging music and far-ranging programming here on KZSU. Of course, KZSU being a nonprofit institution, any contributions to keep KZSU on the air are certainly welcome. And you can go to kzsu.org for more information about that. So thank you again for listening, and I'll look forward to talking to you next week.